Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and we got a show for you tonight. What else is talked about more in Chapel Hill and Durham than the basketball rivalry between Duke and Carolina? And who else are we talking more about than Art Chansky, who has written the book about that rivalry called Blue Blood? And how in the world were we able to get Art Chansky to come talk to us? The only reason I was able to get him to come is I got my circle of experts. First of all, Jeff Hamlin, the sports expert at WCHL, and Tom Drew, the sports expert from Phoenix Communications over in Durham, who knows Duke basketball and Duke athletics inside and out. And because I got those two to join me, Art Chansky, you agreed to come and talk about your book and about the stories around your book.
Yes, it's a pleasure to be here. As I said before we went on the air, this is to be on your show is like intellectual slumming.
For you to come in.
For you or D.G.
No, for me. It's for you. I mean, for me to be on a show where you have such high intelligentsia every night is a true honor and pleasure.
Well, no, there's Chapel Hill, we can pretend that folks are interested in the high-level intellectual topics and Jeez. The great political controversies that we like to have on Who's Talking.
I can relate to what Art's talking about. When I was over at Orange High School at the other end of the county, I studied all night for a urine test. So I don't know.
All right, Jeff. But, Jeff, you would agree that there are more people in Chapel Hill interested in the Duke-Carolina basketball rivalry than there are in the French Revolution.
Yes.
And we're going to talk about Duke-Carolina basketball. Art, tell us about this book. Why everybody knows all these stories, don't they? Doesn't everybody know about the Duke-Carolina rivalry?
Funny, I was on with Mark Packer in Charlotte last week, and he said, why another book on the Duke-Carolina rivalry? Why? You know, and I said, Mark, there's never been one. There have been plenty of books on Carolina and plenty on Duke, but there's never been one on the Duke-Carolina basketball rivalry. There's been one on the football rivalry, but not the basketball. And after working almost 2 years on this book, I can say I'm not surprised. Probably a number of people have started it and then thrown up their hands and not quit, but probably pushed it aside until a later time. It was a daunting task, and if I didn't have people like Tom Drew on my left and some others who have really helped to, you know, balance it. I say on the very first page of the book in the acknowledgments that I had to bring some people in to help who knew the Duke program as well as I knew the Carolina program, because my goal was to make it balanced. My goal was for all those Dukies to say, Chansky, I don't like him, but the book is fair and balanced.
You have know? You succeeded in that, or have you gotten some reports from over in Durham that you tilted towards Carolina in your description?
Well, you know, I haven't gotten any reports like that. There have been a few that have said, he took a couple of shots at this person and that person, but I certainly did the same with Carolina. I tried to make it balanced, and, you know, Tom knows that if Mike Krzyzewski, who's already signed six of these books for various people, if he got word from his people, you know, when his people told him that it wasn't a fair account, he wouldn't have signed those books.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, yeah.
Well, Tom Drew, anything else that I've got? And I'm going to just jump in and start asking questions, but I'd rather you, I mean, got anything else to say about why you stayed the course and took on and continued on this tough course? And
well, I took an extra year to do it. It was really supposed to come out before the 2004-05 season.
Wouldn't have been as good a book if it had.
Well, wouldn't have been. And it was it was after the first year of Roy versus Kay, you know, when everybody thought the rivalry would reignite. And it really didn't. There were two games. Duke won them both. Carolina had a kind of a disappointing first season because of the great expectations that accompanied Roy. But and then Carolina went out after in the second round of the NCAA tournament. Duke had that really heartbreaking, bitter loss to UConn in the semifinals of the Final Four. So, and the manuscript was pretty much done at that point. Except for the current stuff. And so we sat down, the publishers, St. Martin's, Thomas Dunn in New York, and we said, what do you think? And I said, Carolina fans are disappointed. Duke fans really want to forget that the way the season ended. let's hold it for a year. And so we did. And they gave us a chance a whole year to tweak it and put some other things into it, not only the new current stuff, but go back and look at some of the other stuff as well.
I think Art was just celebrating the Red Sox World Series at that point. So
he did that. He did that, Jeff.
Absolutely.
Yeah. He said, you know, he saw all four games live, too.
Really? Is that the truth?
That can make you miss a lot of deadlines. You know?
Yeah. I remember I had Art on my show last year. He went on at length about what it meant to him and his family. And I'm totally just absolutely indifferent when it comes to baseball. But even I was moved because hearing a Boston fan talk about how much it meant to not only himself but his family was just
so you think less. Or you're suggesting that Art got so happy about the Boston Red Sox winning the World Series that he was had to take a few weeks and months off for this project.
I wonder if he
that's
still
actually
wants to be
in the book. He put some of the rivalry in the book.
Art, what did you, just for folks who are thinking about buying the book, what did you set out to accomplish when you start? What was your vision for this book when you started? What did you want to do?
It was trying to make it a history book that didn't read like a history book. And when you say history books, I think that has sort of a boring connotation to it. But when you talk about, our friend John Feinstein writes 400 pages on one team and one season. So when you think about two programs for 60 years, how do you do that and not just list, well, in 1945 this happened and not, So it was really, it had to be somebody who lived the rivalry, lived through it, and could really speak from an anecdotal point of view. But yet, it's hard for that person to be totally objective about it or balanced about it. So, and I knew that. But I've always loved the Duke Carolina rivalry. When I first went to Cameron Indoor Stadium. It was still Duke Indoor Stadium back then. I was captured by it. I loved, obviously, Carmichael Auditorium. I think that the Smith Center has gotten a bad rap, but it's come back in recent years. The crowd's been great, and I think the rivalry right now is going to places where perhaps it's never been before because of Roy and Mike. And it's turned out very luckily to be a great time to have the book out because Carolina won last year. Duke very much overachieved last year, even though they didn't get to the Final Four. I was the only person in Chapel Hill rooting for Duke-Carolina semifinal in St. Louis because it would be great for the book. And that would have been the only better thing if they had met in St. Louis.
Never done that.
Yeah. But so now, that Carolina won last year and Duke is the odds-on favorite to win it this year, it's a perfect time for the book to come out.
Well, I want Jeff and Tom Drew to jump in, but let me ask you just one other question. And if you had to just list the ingredients of the rivalry, you say, oh, Duke and Carolina got a great basketball rivalry, and then you try to dissect it into what its parts are, coaches, students, great basketball pro. How do you dissect it so that you can give us more than just, hey, this is a great rivalry, and here are the things that are happened?
Well, good question. I wasn't sure, and I addressed that also in the acknowledgments. There are a lot of evenings looking at a blank screen or looking at a manuscript at how you've been written and saying, is this the right direction? Because I wrote a book called Dean's Domain 5 years ago, sort of a biography on Dean Smith that really dealt with, it wasn't a chronology. It had chapters of recruiting stories, part one, recruiting stories, part two, that covered recruiting stories over a wide expanse of time. So I wasn't really sure, and I would go off this way and go off that way. And we finally came back and decided that it's not exactly a chronology because it begins with the last two seasons, but then it goes back to the late 50s and 60s where the rivalry really flourished. It really blossomed.
So you didn't take a chronological view. You started in the present. And
I
then
did,
started
and then out. I went back to the Heyman-Brown era when the rivalry exploded and transformed from a football rivalry to a basketball rivalry. And then went all the way chronologically from that point. But during that, worked in the common recruiting battles, worked in the great games and the incidents that happened off the court, the controversies.
All right, well, one more question, and then Tom and Jeff, it's for y'all for a while. Mm-hmm. But is it fair to say that you can define the rivalry mostly by talking about the people that the other side hate the most?
In a sense, because it's a rivalry where both parties are constantly watching each other. The old thing is that I won a doubleheader today. Duke won and Carolina lost, or Carolina won and Duke lost. And for the real diehards and the people who don't have the great mental health that that me and when I was and this book has really given me a great balance on the rivalry and a lot of appreciation.
You're too objective now to be any fun.
Duke, exactly right. But you know when you there aren't that many people around here that can root for Duke, Carolina fans who can root for Duke when Carolina's out and vice versa. But some can. But the rivalry is defined, I think, by the fact that the fans watch both programs. You know, they
who's,
watch.
Who's the most hated person of all?
Oh, on depends on which side.
Well
on Carolina's side, Krzyzewski,
yeah.
Maybe as a player, Christian Laettner.
Yeah.
On the Carolina side,
Coach Smith.
Yeah, not hated. But you know,
not like Krzyzewski, but still
because,
disliked.
Yeah, because Dean didn't really, he didn't do a lot. He spent a lot of time trying to protect his image or trying to push his image off to the side in lieu of the players themselves.
So. In its own way, Art, you told me the other night on my show that in some ways Frank McGuire, because of his flamboyant personality. Mm-hmm. Left himself open.
There was no
scorn.
You know, the thing about it, PC back then meant, we used to joke as kids, PC meant privileged character, not political correctness. There was nothing PC about the rivalry. People think it's intense now. Tommy knows, Jeff's not old enough to know. You're old enough to know, GG, that in the 50s and 60s, there was no political correctness. There was nothing. I mean, sports writers used phrases like crucified in their columns, and fans threw stuff on the court at each other. Mm-hmm. There were fights all the time. Fights in college basketball were commonplace. It was a fight between Wake Forest and Carolina in 1 year over in Winston-Salem where it was so bad that when the fight stopped, the ref threw everybody who had played in the game out of the game, sent him to the locker room, and made the last five players on each bench who hadn't suited up finish the game. That's how bad it was. Bones McKinney, who was a minister, also was a basketball coach, just to make enough money to put food on the table, he got dicked during that game. You know? So it was very commonplace. And when it happened with Duke and Carolina, we'll talk about it in 61, it was the culmination of what had been going on during the point-shaving scandals and fights of the late 50s.
I remember there was one story where Bones McKinney used some language that, shall we say, was not associated with an ordained minister, and the referee he was talking to looked at him and said, I thought you were a minister, and Bones said, well, I thought you were a referee, so
that's great.
One of those things. But anyway.
It's time for us to take a break. We're waiting for Tom Drew to ask the first question. Art Chansky, Jeff Hamlin, and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. We're talking about Blue Blood. It's the Duke Carolina Inside the Most Storied Rivalry in College Sports, authored by our friend Art Chansky. And we're talking about that book. Tom Drew and Jeff Hamlin and I are visiting with Art Chansky. And Tom Drew, you've been mighty quiet.
How can I get a word in, Edgewise?
Well, it's your turn.
All right. Well, the only thing is you asked the question about the rivalry. The rivalry is really carried by the fans, DG, because a lot of the players come so close to going to the other school that they have a lot of respect. Now, that hadn't always been the case. I mean, Brown and Heyman hated each other, and you come on up to J.R. Reed and Danny Ferry. But the players go to the same barbershops, play together in the summer, and I think the coaches have a lot of respect for each other. But the fans, oh, man, they're people who won't even watch games on TV, record it, and find out who won because they can't stand it. Somewhere.
And a lot of that is fans can't control anything that happens on the court, so the players feel like they can control it because they're playing in the game. But one of the great revelations that came to me while this was going on, and I guess I knew it subconsciously, but Bubas and Dean Smith, Vic Bubas and Dean Smith, two fiery Midwestern but gentlemen who love basketball and really thought of the good of the game more than the fact that they were coaching at Duke and Carolina. And they really put a mutual respect that did not exist in the late 50s. I mean, there was a point shaving scandal. There's a touch of it in the book. Carolina in 1960 beat Duke three times during their season, Dixie Classic and the home and home by an average of 22 points. And then they go to the semifinals of the ACC tournament, and there's no way that Duke could beat them. But Carolina loses, and that was in the middle of the point-shaving scandal, and nobody blew the whistle on anybody, but that was the perfect game for somebody to approach somebody in the Carolina team and say, look, we don't want you to lose the game. Just don't win by don't cover the spread, which was 20. That kind of stuff was going on, the fights, the Brown-Hammond recruiting stuff, and then the fight that they had in Silo City as a freshman where Killer Krause from Carolina cold-cocked Heyman, sent him to the hospital with 6 stitches. Everybody thought it was a hit that Maguire put out on him because the game was at Silo City. It was off either campus. It was sort of under nobody's jurisdiction, freshman ball, none of the campuses. So it was a good place to have it, you know. It's like
Heyman got kicked by those alligator shoes.
Like a Coach Vito McGuire. Corleone hit. But then the next year, they had the sophomore game, and, you know, there was the big pile where Heyman claimed he was kicked by alligator shoes at the bottom of the pile, which only Frank Maguire wore. So then Maguire was left, you know, he was a very unpopular or a very controversial figure in Chapel Hill when he left after the 1961 season. And Bill Aycock elevated Dean Smith, and Vic Bubas had come in. He had been hired by Eddie Cameron off of Everett Case's staff. And these two Midwestern guys, you know, the rivalry was as fierce and intense as any, but they were able to raise it above and create a mutual respect, I think, that still exists. And amongst the fans who hate each other, the fans really don't like it, you know, when the other team is down. They want to beat the other's brains in, but they want to do it when they're a top 10 team.
There's so many great stories in your book, and one of them, which I think is intrigues us here in Chapel Hill, is the story of Frank McGuire's departure under kind of bad circumstances from Chapel Hill. In the 1957 season, he was the hero forever in Chapel Hill, and for some of us still is, for having brought that championship to the University of North Carolina. It's almost like a Greek tragedy, isn't it? Tell us that story.
When I was here, I wasn't here when McGuire was here, but one of my first years at Carolina was 1968, and I went to the Carolina. I was kind of starting to work for the Daily Tar Heel, so I sat up in the catwalk at Carmack, where you could see you weren't in the crowd, but you could see the crowd as one. And it was Larry Miller's last home game was against South Carolina. And UNC Carolina was 10-0 in the league. They had already won the league, and 12-0. And they had two last games, but they had already won the league. The last week of the season, they played South Carolina home and Duke on the road. And I'll never forget it, DG and Tom and Jeff, when the South Carolina came out to warm up, Maguire didn't come with him. That was his deal. He stayed back in the locker room until, you know, the final curtain call just before the game started. And when Frank Maguire came out, and this is 1968. Now, this is only 7 years removed from when he left Chapel Hill, still 11 years from the Maguire's miracle in 1957. So everybody there knew who he was. This is the closest thing to Elvis Presley I've ever seen. Here's a guy coming out with, back then, it must have been a $500 silk suit, you know, with the jewelry and everything. And this guy comes out, and there was an aura in Carmichael Auditorium that I think about it now, the hair raises in my arms. This is a guy who left Chapel Hill under, you know, very controversial, tragic circumstances, but gave UNC and the state of North Carolina still its biggest athletic fable of all time, the 1957 undefeated team. And when he took the court, I mean, it was something that I went, whoa, I've never seen anything like this. I mean, there was the atmosphere, it was a buzz, there was some booze, there was, it was that aura, there was everything.
There he is.
And
there
he had a good team. He had a great team,
and they ended up beating Carolina that night. And
Gary Greger.
Yeah, and Bobby Kremins.
Al Salvadori.
Bobby Kremins tells the funny story about how, you know, he was kind of shy with girls, and he was the worst free throw shooter on that team percentage-wise. And as the Tar Heels were behind, Dean kept telling his guys to foul Kremins, send him to the line. He ended up making 15 of 18, and South Carolina hung on to win the game. And when he got off the bus in Columbia that night, about 9 girls wanted to take him back to the dorm that night because he was the hero, and he always thanked Dean Smith for it. But that was the Maguire that I saw.
Maguire called ahead on that story.
And then I began to understand the legend of Maguire and began to look at it and read about it and study it when he was here. I mean, when he came back in 57, they gave him a Cadillac, and he had open charge accounts all over town. But he was a big timer. You know, he was a New York big time Frank McGuire. He was the Irishman, and he rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. And once it started going south on him, you know, things started to fall apart. And Bill Aycock stood up to him, because Bill Aycock really didn't care about the national championship. He cared more about the product that the coach put out.
Well, I want to ask you this, because you talk about in your book, you talk about not only the struggle between Chancellor Aycock and Coach McGuire, but also the struggle between other coaches and successor leaders. I think the most interesting to me were Coach Krzyzewski's struggle with, or his dance with President Broadhead when President Broadhead came. Is it different now? Can a university head stand up to these basketball coaches, powerful basketball coaches at Carolina and Duke?
It's harder now, I think, because there's so much money involved.
Oh, it's an incredible entanglement with the networks and the shoe contracts and the coaches, other sports.
The coaches represent such a revenue stream. Not only that, but it's just not money. It's applicant pools. It's fundraising, development, and other areas. You know, the basketball programs at Duke and Carolina are they're the symbol of the universities. And, you know, Dick Broadhead, when he came in the first week, Mike Krzyzewski's going to the Lakers. Well, in 1994, the first year that Nan Kahan came in, and Mike Krzyzewski's going to the Portland Trailblazers. Mm-hmm. You know, and so, you know, she called back from vacation. She came from Wellesley College, and she didn't really understand, why is this guy, doesn't this guy have to answer to anybody? I mean, you know, he can do what he wants. Everybody's going, yeah, he can do what he wants, yeah. I mean, because he's not a bad guy, obviously, but he's a very powerful figure, and standards are in the right place, but she didn't understand that. She did, though, when she was called back from vacation and told that he's getting ready to go take the Portland Trail Blazers.
Because he's unhappy, yeah.
So she calls him and says, don't do anything, I'm coming back, you know. And don't do anything until we meet again.
Meet me in my office.
Right.
And you think about that, and you think about where Mike Krzyzewski was when there was talk he could lose his job back in the mid-'80s. And both of you, all of you know that period very well. And Tom, maybe you can back me up on this. Maybe you can, Art. But the night that Tom Butters decided to give Krzyzewski a contract extension, it came when Duke lost to Carolina in what is known as the double standard game. Legend has it that – is that – you're shaking your head.
No, it's not right. That's why you have to read the book, Jeff.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Take notes.
Okay? I'm sorry.
It actually came after a 21-point double-digit loss at Wake Forest.
Okay.
And, you know – people were still – they were howling about Mike Krzyzewski. And Tom Butters tells a story about back then when Mike was tense and uptight. You know, his lips would get really thin, you know, and as everybody knew he was tense. So after that 21-point loss, Butters walks into the office. He says to Donna Keene, the secretary, Mike here yet? She says, no, he's not in yet. Tom says, tell him I want to see him in my office when he comes in. Donna says, your office? Tom says, my office. And so Mike comes in. Mr. Butters wants to see in his office. He thinks he's getting fired.
He did.
Yeah, so he goes in there, and, you know, because he thinks he's getting fired. And he sits down, and, you know, Tom, if you know Tom Butters, you know he's dramatic. He goes, Mike, the public doesn't know what kind of basketball coach we have here. The press is too dumb to report what kind of a basketball coach we have here. And as I look across my desk at you, I'm not even sure that our basketball coach knows what kind of a basketball coach we have here. And he opens up his drawer and takes a document out. It's his contract. He says, this is a new 5-year contract. I want you to announce it.
Wow. And is it true that after that night, the day it was announced, Tom Butters got death threats?
He got several.
Oh, yeah.
And the greatest one, should I tell him this? Because it's in the book. But Tom, he comes home from dinner. His teenage daughter, Jill, is crying. And she says, Dad, are you going to Atlanta tomorrow? And Tom says, yeah, I am. And she said, well, I just got a phone call from someone who said, tell your daddy better not be on that plane to Atlanta in the morning.
That's true.
Wow.
So Tom says, oh, that's just a joke, Jill. Says Jill up to bed, you know. And Lynn, his wife, says to him, Tom, are you kidding? Is that a joke? He goes, oh, that's a joke. That's a bad joke, but it's a joke. But Lynn, would you do me a favor tomorrow morning when we get up? She said, what's that? She said, would you go out and start my car?
Well, it was that bad. Well, there were, I guess, there are two periods in Duke and Carolina basketball, one in each situation, where there is a real terrible struggle about coaches. Once at Duke, when my buddy Neil McGay was the interim coach, and the other Carolina, when we had what I'd call a transition coach here, a great guy, another good friend, that didn't work. Things just weren't working, and it was almost like the other school had a permanent, you know, solid situation, and either Duke or Carolina was struggling.
You can say the words Matt Daugherty.
were those comparable periods, and did we learn anything? Did the schools learn anything from those stories?
Well, they're not comparable in the respect that when Duke left, it was because Bucky wanted a vote of confidence from Duke in 1973, and he kept asking for it, Tom, and they couldn't get it. He wouldn't give it. They wanted him just to keep coaching. He was going to his last year of his – I guess it was going to the last year of his contract or the last 2 years of his contract, and he wouldn't get it. So he quit in September with a down program, and that it had a losing season before, and Duke actually –
He wasn't fired. He quit.
No, he stepped down in September, which was a very, very difficult thing.
As a gotcha kind of thing?
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I think so. No sitting coach is going to come, you know, while school has already started. So, but I know Jeff's is telling you to take a break, and we'll tell you when you get back. But
It's a great story. We'll take a break. Yeah, okay. We'll be right back.
We'll tell you what happened after that.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. Jeff Hamlin, Tom Drew, and I are talking to Art Chansky, who's telling us about his book, Blue Blood, which is the inside story of the most storied rivalry in college sports. And we're pulling some stories out of that even are in the book, and you're telling us about some of the tough transition times in coaching. And how about telling us, we interrupted you in the break, but tell us the whole story.
Yeah, that 1973 when Bucky resigned at Duke, and it was too late to get a sitting head coach because school had already started. And so Duke was kind of in a bind. I had 2 years ago, I had worked at the Atlanta Constitution, and they had a prank that they played on Cub reporters. You know, you go in there, and they said, one of the initiations here is that you have to try and get Adolph Rupp, the Baron of the Bluegrass, the coach, legendary coach of Kentucky, on the phone, get an interview with him. No one has ever done
it. They tell you that nobody's ever done this.
No one has ever done it.
So were you able to get him? Were you able to get him on the phone?
So they give me the number, and I call him up, and he answers the phone, and you know, an hour later, you can't get him off the phone because he's talking about farming and bees and birds and basketball and everything, and I turn around, all the guys are laughing behind me because anybody could get him on the phone. Nobody could get him off the phone. But I had his number in my book. So in 1973, when Duke was trying to figure out who to hire as a basketball coach and to do something dramatic, remember, NC State had David Thompson, Carolina had Dean Smith and its great teams, and Duke was last in the league and not very good. Carl James was the athletic director, searching around, trying to figure out what can I do to bring the eyes of the world back to Duke basketball. And the rumor would not go away that they were trying to bring Adolph Rupp out of retirement. He'd been banished by Kentucky to his cattle farm, literally sent out to pasture in 1972.
So Duke was seriously thinking about bringing Rupp to coach.
So the rumor wouldn't die. Everybody thought it was ridiculous. My guy was 72 years old, right? And you know, and he left Kentucky because they said he was too old, little senile, had the gout, all that kind of stuff. So the rumor wouldn't die. So I said, "What the hell? I've got a member. I have his number in my book from when I worked in Atlanta." I call him up, dial the number, call him up. Coach Rupp answered the phone. I wasn't surprised. And I said, Coach Rupp, this is I'm calling from Durham, North Carolina. I said, "You're calling from Durham, North Carolina?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "You know Carl James, the Duke athletic?" I said, "Yes, sir, I do." He said, "Will you call Carl James for me? You know, we've had an electrical storm up here, and I can't make any outgoing calls. I don't know how you got in. Would you call Carl James for me?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I will. What would you like me to tell him?" He said, "Tell him not to send that plane for me on Thursday because I cannot come and coach his basketball team." I went, "Woo."
Okay. So you had a scoop.
I said, "What?" And he said, "Yeah, my farm manager, Carl Yazell." I'll never forget his name. Yazell. Carl Yazell dropped dead this afternoon, and he's got a 500-acre farm here, and I can't leave. So would you call Carl James, tell him not to send that plane? Said, yes, sir, I will call him. Yeah. Thank you very much. Boom, call him up.
Well.
I said, I got a scoop here, you know. So,
you had the scoop, but what happened to Duke basketball?
Well, I called Carl and told him, and he said, it was a long pause. Well, you know, Tom, how he started.
And he didn't believe you.
All right, thank you very much. Thank you. You know, he thought I was playing to
check it out.
Thought I was playing a joke on him. Boom. But they ended up hiring Neil McGahee, who was the one assistant with the most seniority on Bucky's staff, and they hired him as the interim coach. We had a big story in the paper that morning that Rupp was coming, and then he wasn't. And Carl, bless his heart, and may he rest in peace, denied that. I had an argument with Carl in his office afterwards. He denied at the press conference that they ever offered Adolph Rupp the job, and I said, Carl, you embarrass me. We had this paper. You say it's completely wrong. If it wasn't for me, you'd still be waiting for Adolph Rupp to show up here.
Wasn't there some type of a confrontation at the press conference?
Yeah, it was me. With me.
Yeah. It was at the press conference.
Somebody asked him about Rupp. He said, oh, that's not true. That's not true. We never hired Adolph Rupp. We never offered Adolph Rupp the job. And I knew Neil was a friend of mine. I talked to him, and he told me 9 o'clock that morning, Carl James offered him the job that morning. The press conference was 11. And again, 9 o'clock, he called him in his office and said, okay, you got a one-year contract as the interim coach. That's how... You know, the amazing thing about the evolution of the rivalry and the evolution of Duke basketball, and Tommy, you know this, that's how hurting Duke was. Duke was trying to figure out how to get out of the Doug Knight situation in the 60s where they weren't sure whether they wanted to emphasize or de-emphasize. The Duke employees back then joked about their paychecks bouncing. I mean, it was incredible until Tom Butters took over as athletic director.
Under Terry Sanford.
And began raising money and began restoring the hope for the future in Duke athletics. They were all about, you know, the Rose Bowl and the bowl teams, the Orange Bowls they had under Bill Murray. They were going nowhere. And Mike Krzyzewski, what he has done is amazing. But when you consider the context, you know, and the history and the lack of resources they had at one time, this little school. And Tom has a quote right here in the back of this book. He says, 8 miles away sat a legend, perhaps the greatest coach of all time. I was inundated with thoughts of beating Dean Smith. If we couldn't beat him, we could never get to where we were thinking about going. Tom Butters thought about, he was obsessed with the fact that they got this guy over there. What are we going to do here? And so he gambled on this guy, Krzyzewski, who he really felt... And this is. I'm jumping ahead. This is after.
Let's take a break. I want to hear this whole story.
I want to hear this whole story.
Right. We're going to take a break. Going to come back, and Art Chancey's going to tell us about how we got from the departure of Bucky Walters to Mike Krzyzewski in charge. Welcome back to Who's Talking. Jeff Hamlin and Tom Drew and I are talking to Art Chansky about Blue Blood, Art Chansky's new book about the Carolina-Duke basketball rivalry, and got too many things to talk about. Art, but I do want to find out, in summary, what's the story about how Duke resurrected itself out of Bucky Walters leaving and through the transition period? Adolph Rupp.
Well, McGahee was here for 1 year. He coached the 2 games. They actually, Duke won its 1,000th game in history in the season where they only won 10 games, but he coached in the famous 8.17 seconds. But even if Carolina hadn't come back and won that game, he wouldn't have gotten the job because Carl James was out looking for an experienced head coach. He got Bill Foster, and Bill was 3 years rebuilding the program. Then he recruited Mike Juminski after Carolina told Mike Juminski, we don't think you can play. We think you're too slow. So then, can you believe that? He wanted to go to Carolina. It was his first choice.
Oh, he told Jason Williams almost the same thing.
Exactly. So, you know, so he resurrects it with Juminski and Banks and Denard and those guys, and then he leaves, and then Butters takes a shot on hiring Krzyzewski.
Why did Butters like Krzyzewski?
It was a hint. It was a hunch, really. But you know, Tom grew up in the same hometown as Bobby Knight, and Knight was his idol. So he called Knight, and he wanted a coach who would coach defense, and he asked him about it. And Steve Vasendak was really the key. He had just hired Steve, former great player at Duke, as his assistant, and Vasendak had been working for Converse Shoe Company up in the Northeast, and he Army and Navy were his two accounts, two of his accounts. And he had time to watch Krzyzewski's teams, and he kept convincing Butters. He kept trying to convince Butters, this is the guy I should hire. You're going to get a lot of grief for it, but this is the guy. This is the long-term guy. And Butters interviewed him about five times, and finally he hired him. And life
has never been the same.
Well, never has. And I guess, you know, Jeff mentioned the rough goings Mike had as Duke, as Dean had at Carolina and so forth. But it all started with getting the recruits, you know, getting the guys. And first year, Mike got close to everybody and didn't get anybody. And finally, you know, he was in this home of Mark Akers, a guy in the Midwest, and he knew he wasn't going to get him midway through the visit, so he started to wrap up the visit. And this is where Duke was still down. Carolina was on top of the mountain. And he said to Mrs. Akers, is there anything else, you know, that you'd like, any other questions you'd like to answer? And she said, no, I just want Mark to go someplace where he'll be close to God. And Krzyzewski felt a little smile coming up, and he knew he wasn't getting the kid anyway. He said, well, Mrs. Akers, if he comes to Duke, he'll be 8 miles from God. But the next year, you know, he got the Dawkins class, and then he beat Carolina for Ferry, and then eventually Grand Hill. And as Tom said, that's really Eric Montross thought he was going to Duke, and Mike, and then he liked Carolina better. So it's a lot of these recruits have been back and forth.
Lebo Snyder, yeah. You know, Hurley, yeah. You know.
Hurley, you know, he asked Hurley to wait. Dean asked Hurley to wait on Kenny Anderson's decision, which he had done successfully for years. But recruiting was different back then because AAUs and recruiting ratings and all that. Families didn't want to wait. They didn't want to. They wanted to be number one. And Krzyzewski knew that, so he stopped recruiting Anderson, told Hurley, we want you. They don't want you. We want you. You know, we want you to be our point guard.
Wow. Well, there's just so much to talk about. I guess in bottom line, is it recruiting, or is it on the court coaching, or is it preparation for the game coaching style that is the critical difference in the greatness at Duke and Carolina?
It's a combination of both. You can be the greatest coach in the world, but if you don't have good players, you know, and it can have great players and not necessarily win with them. And the other great thing is contrasting styles. You know, the Carolina program is built on one style of basketball. Duke is built on another, but and a lot of things that Mike Krzyzewski did when he came in, he emulated Dean Smith, but a number of things he said, I want to do them differently. Yeah. You know, I want to do them better.
Well, Art Chansky, thanks so much. I guess we're going to have to say at this point, you're going to have to go buy the book, buy it for yourself, buy it for your friends for Christmas.
I'm reading it for the second time.
Tom Drew and Jeff Hammond, thanks so much. Thanks to all y'all for listening. We'll be back same time tomorrow.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Carolina football. This is the only station you need to follow the Tar Heels all season.